Today on our PACE podcast, we are joined by Amy Edmondson, Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School, an international thought leader. She is a trailblazer in the field of psychological safety in the workplace. Her most recent book, The Fearless Organization, is the thorough guide for leaders and teams today. So, Amy, why fearless? When I saw it, I thought, wow, what's the story behind it?
You know, I have been studying psychological safety for a long time. As you may not know, psychological safety means an absence of interpersonal fear. And to have psychological safety as the book title did not strike me as very engaging or compelling. So I thought a lot about many different options and things. It's better to put the aspirational title out, you know, to put out that when people can come to work unafraid, they can make their contributions.
In 2012, I make a decision to actually go on to the word real, being real. So I wrote a few books on real. I had a real conversation, real help, real relationship, very similar to the way you have positioned it. I'm also a great advocacy of psychological safety. So I'm totally aligned with you.
It's about being authentic, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, you know, interaction. So, you know, maybe we can both now really ask ourselves, what is concept of psychological safety and why it matters? Because especially in Asia, I would like to say that I'm not saying that we are not able to, but I think the concept of psychological safety and why it matters has probably not been very clear.
Yeah. I'm sure you're right. And so why does it matter? It matters because we, like it or not, we live in the knowledge era. We live in an era where your company's success depends on your ability as leaders and as managers to get the knowledge and the insight and the ingenuity out of people's heads and expressed out loud so that it can be put to work. And that's not natural. And that's especially not natural in Asian countries. And yet it's still mission critical to success, right? If you want innovation, if you want problem solving, if you want continuous improvement, you need people to be willing to speak up. And to be willing to speak up means you need to be willing to take what I call interpersonal risks. Mm-hmm. And again, that's not natural. It's not natural in Asia. Truthfully, it's not natural anywhere. But it can be developed and nurtured anywhere.
And I think a lot of people think psychological safety is there, is present, right? It's such in a subconscious mind. But like what you said, if it's present, then we must be willing to take the psychological risk, right? So I came out with this model. I call it psychological equilibrium. If a person's if a person's psychological safety is affected, they will not take psychological risk.
Sure. Right. So if you think about it, we are always calibrating. Right? We're always sizing up the environment and deciding what's okay and what's acceptable. What's going to get us in trouble? What's going to get us ahead? And here's the problem. There is a profound asymmetry between voice and silence, right? Sometimes I might speak up and people will say, oh, thank you so much, right? That was really helpful. But sometimes I might speak up and they would say, that's terrible. Why did you open your mouth, right? And the problem is there's really three categories, because there's the category where I had something to say, but I stayed silent. Nobody praises me, but nobody gets mad at me either. And so we're always, as human beings, we're always going to lean toward the side of silence, right? Silence is cost free, and voice is might be good, but it's more it might be bad and we're worried about the bad, right? And then the Kahneman and Tversky told us that there's loss aversion therapy. We're very anxious not to incur losses. We're more anxious not to incur losses than we are eager to incur gains. So what that means is, by and large, people will stay silent unless they have really understood this to be the kind of environment where voice and authenticity are valued.
And therefore, that leads us to really the next very critical question is, how can leaders then facilitate that psychological safety with teams? Because we both know that it's so, I like the word mission critical. I really like what you just said. And really, I mean, in your research, you know, you have I would say the name for teaming. I mean, you know that the background that you have, evolved over the importance of team. And I really like to spend a little bit of time here because in Asia, we believe in team, right? But yeah, I would say that very similar to what you experienced, like you said it, you know, how could we facilitate psychological safety and not just getting teams together to brainstorm, but yet we don't have an outcome, right? We are not right to solve the real issues, right? So how could leaders do that better?
Well, team, you know, there are two ways to think about team. Hmm. Right. And one is just communal spirit. And I think that's very strong in Asia, yes, clearly.
Yes.
But the other meaning of team is diverse knowledge or expertise or ideas coming together to create synergy, to create something that is unpredicted by the sum of the parts. Hmm. And that kind of team only works when people are willing to get into conflict and willing to disagree, where face saving is secondary. So just because one has a more communal cooperative spirit doesn't mean you're well set up to be a great team, right? Because to really be a great team, you have to be willing to disagree and speak up and be unpopular for a little bit of time. And so you've got to kind of work on creating the kind of teamwork that gets the most out of a set of diverse experts.
And also, I think, so when you say that, you know, how do we get synergy? I mean, many a times we use the word synergy, and I always said, now, do you have synchronized energy, you know, exhibiting out of this whole session? So how could we, I think in your book, you mentioned the power of questions, right? You know, how do we do that as leaders?
Yeah, right. So you started to say, you know, what is it that leaders can do? And I think there's, to get the good kind of teamwork, meaning the powerful, more than the sum of the parts kind of teamwork, right. I think there's three main things. And the inquiry, the questions are in the middle. The first one is just to be very clear that it's needed, meaning be very clear that we're up against a challenge that nobody's ever faced before, you know, whether that's continuous improvement on the line in the production facility or a brand new product or a brand new strategy, right? So you have to be very clear that we're trying to do something that we've never done before, which means A, we need to hear from everybody, and B, we're going to make mistakes or we're going to have failures on the way to success. So what you do is you set the stage by framing the work as a learning problem. It's not pure execution. Number two, if you have a learning problem, you have to go out of your way to solicit input. So you are overtly saying, you know, Lily, what's on your mind? What do you see? What thoughts do you have? What does your expertise tell us about this problem? And you facilitate that kind of discussion. And then finally, when people do speak up with an idea, you don't say things like, oh, that's a stupid idea. You say, oh, thank you. Doesn't mean you have to act on it. It doesn't mean you have to love it. It does mean you have to appreciate the humanity that brought it forward, right? So thank you. Thank you, Lily. And then forward looking, right? We're always saying, how can we do better? How can we offer more of our thoughts? How can we inquire more of other people's thoughts? And how can we solve problems? Because I think the name of the game is really problem solving from here forever. We're never going to stop problem solving. Mm. But problem solving is something that you have to be brave and, you know, willing to be willing to get it wrong while you're working on getting it right.
You know, there's something that I find in Asia context that I felt that I like to maybe bring it to us a level of discussion here, is that there are multi-generation that we are managing right now. So if you are talking about the baby boomers, or you know, the generation at that time, they are seemingly put on a higher platform, like you are the knowledge, you are the expert domain knowledge. And therefore, for them to let go of their ego state, I call it, yeah, it is unconscious, right? And especially if you to walk into a Japanese or you walk into a different kind of context where hierarchical, power, position power is really so much higher. So I'm just thinking out loud. But yet, the younger generation coming in require you to be more inclusive, right? I mean, you think about it. And
yes.
So how do we actually help, you know, this context, I would say, where we have to... So if I am of a lower position and I want my leader to facilitate that, is there a way that I could do it? And I saw that.
Oh,
yeah. The inquiry mode. Is there
yes.
a way we could use?
Yes. That? I mean, so someone in a lower
yes.
position
right.
can make a big difference because he or she can use inquiry. And as long as it's in a thoughtful and genuine spirit, it will make a difference, right? So you're not saying, okay, everybody, I think we should do this because you're not the boss. You can't do that. But if you say, wow, that's really interesting. I'd love to understand it better. Or could we think about it like this? You know, you will get people, what you will do is not only be heard, but you will also help the conversation move forward.
Mm-hmm. And that brings me to another question. What if there is a team of people, leaders, younger leaders who come to you and say, Amy, we have done that. We were very inquiry, but you know, we keep getting shut off and we are not successful. So what else can they do?
Well, you know what you do is you make that, see, that's a problem, right? That's a difficulty that they just had. And what they have to do now is make that difficulty a source of curiosity. Because what happens is our human brains tend to conclude that we know the reason, right? It didn't go well, it didn't work. And so what we say is, well, those guys are just not very open, right? They're not willing. And we forget that, well, maybe I didn't do it very well, or maybe, you know, maybe I should try again, right? So what you can do, and this is brave, but I think doable, is make the very problem you just experienced a source of curiosity. Instead of a source of judgment, make it a source of curiosity, and then bring that up. And then what you do is you say, I'm puzzled by some of the conversations we have. I need your help. That's the most important line there ever was. I need your help. I don't understand it very well. I'd love to know better. And by the way, I'm just trying so hard to contribute to the project.
That's right.
And I'm not confident that I'm contributing effectively. And here's why I'm not confident. Because when I tried XYZ, either nothing happened or I felt that I got shot down. Now, I may have interpreted that wrong. Mm. Right? But what you're doing is you're at least remembering maybe you're wrong, right?
Mm. Mm. I totally agree with you. And I think that's why your title is so apt here, being fearless.
Oh, good.
Being fearless, right? Because what you're saying here is if you are genuinely curious, right? With an intention to solve the problem, then you could go into the conversation exactly what you said.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. And I.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. You, because if you're genuine, if you're sort of saying, yeah. I had hoped that would work better than it did.
Yeah.
And then, and maybe these people are, they do have some wisdom. They do have some experience. So your real job is to learn, not to show off and not to be right. It's to learn. And their job is to help you learn. They may not be doing their job perfectly, but you might not be doing your job perfectly either. So we're all fallible human beings, you know, trying to make progress in a very complicated world. And as long as you, you know, and none of us, this is not easy, right? But as long as you can keep putting yourself back into the spirit of, okay, I want to learn.
Right? Also, the other thing that in my experience is also a relationship of trust. I felt that it's also as a speaker or as a listener in the process of problem solving or inquiry, we have to really do a bit of this deep level of trust, meaning that psychological safety and risk can happen when the relationship is built on trust. Means that the team, very core fundamental is we trust each other because, like what you said, we have a shared agenda, we have a shared problem, we have a shared aspirations.
Right, and we're going to make mistakes, and we're going to get things wrong. But we're also, we know that we're all on the same side.
So let's talk about a mistake, because in Asia, making a mistake is a big deal.
Well, you know, I shouldn't use the word mistake so often because it's failure, right? I make a distinction between mistake and failure.
Yes.
A mistake is defined as something that goes wrong where I could have known better. Right. I mean, there is a process that's supposed to be done one way, and by mistake, I did it the wrong way, either because I had a lapse of judgment or memory, or I was too sleepy or something, right? So that's a mistake. But a failure is very different, right? A failure is a bigger category, and a failure includes mistakes because a mistake's a failure, but a failure also includes scientific experiments that didn't produce the result we wanted. And so the territory from, and by the way, failure also includes sabotage, you know, people deliberately doing harm, right? And so that's a big, failure is a big, big category. And what I want to say to people in Asia who say, well, we can't make mistakes or we can't have failures is, that's a problematic view because there will be failures because we live in a volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous world. So failure will happen. The only question, that's not a question. The only question is how will you respond to it? Will you respond to it in a learning-oriented way that helps you get better? Or will you respond to it in a non-learning-oriented way that virtually guarantees that similar things will happen in the future?
I mean, I really like the word you use, learning orientation, because I think that would resonate a lot with the people in Asia, because I think there's so much hunger to learn, so much hunger
I agree.
Better. And also in the COVID-19, and now that we are moving towards post-COVID-19, I think people definitely need this because they need to be fearless, because I can't imagine, because jobs are gone, business are gone, globalization is...
entrepreneurship, we need everything.
That's right. And I think far more people need this now. And then that leads us to, you know, when you say that silence was generally good, when are the occasions where silence is dangerous and the impact of dangerous silence?
Well, I mean, silence is complicated because silence is the default, right? It's, no one ever got fired for silence.
That's right. You said the cost of silence, right?
Right. Silence is easy. Voice is harder. And I want to be clear, there is productive silence and problematic silence. So here's problematic silence. That's when someone doesn't speak up with a work relevant idea, question, concern, mistake, right? Anything that's work relevant that could be shared, but you choose not to. Or when you hold back, you're silent about a potential risk, not just to the business, but to human safety, right? Or you hold back an idea that could be an improvement idea or an innovation idea. Or you don't ask a question where if you'd asked the question, you could have done a better job, right? So those are all problematic. I think we can agree about that. But productive silence is when you hold back an irrelevant idea. You know, I don't just with you right now start talking about what I'm going to have for dinner tonight because it's, you know, or when I hold back a very rude thought or something that's off topic or confidential, you know, security issue. And so all of, you know, there's obviously things for which it is proper and productive to not speak about them right now. And what I like to say is the litmus test is whether you should speak or whether you should speak or stay silent. If you are staying silent because you're concerned about how you will look, that's a problem. If you're staying silent, but you're honestly focused on the mission and you judge that what the thought that just went through your head isn't that relevant, then that's good.
Yeah, I like the part about the way you said about the litmus test, because I think in the Asia context, I think it's really very key. I just want to reiterate the importance, like when you stay silent, why? Was it because, you know, you didn't want to look bad? You didn't want to look vulnerable? But I think when we stay silent, it's because we want to focus on the mission, the shared mission. Yeah, I think that is so important.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really like it because we do have people who are very vocal. You know, for saying that people are pretty, you know, respectful, collaborative, but you do have people who are so vocal that you'd be surprised that they don't say silence because they don't focus on the mission. They keep reflecting on themselves looking good.
Yes. You know, not and that's not good.
Yeah. So that is really something that I thought was good. So, you know, then I like to, then of course, your book has full of wisdom there. I like the word humility, humble.
Yes. Yes. So do
Can
I.
You tell us about that because, I mean, it's very unusual.
Well,
I mean, I felt very unusual. I just hope I didn't offend anyone here out there. Is that, you know, like to say that, you know, please have some humility. Please be humble. It's like, oh, when I was,
Maybe this helps. I mean, Ed Schein, who was the MIT professor emeritus, would use the term situational humility. Right? And it helps, I think, because what it does is it clarifies that being humble is logical and wise when you're in a situation where you don't have all the answers. Now, nowadays, not just COVID-19, but more generally, more often than not, we're in a situation where we don't have all the answers. And so we should be, if we're smart, if we're wise, we should be situationally humble. Right? It doesn't mean I have to say, oh, I'm no good at maths or I'm no, you know, there's many things you might be very good at. It's not that kind of humility. It's humility about the challenge that lies ahead.
I think that's excellent. Yeah. And I think then that takes away, right? The attachment of the ego state, I felt.
Yeah.
Because
not about you. Yeah. It's about reality.
That's right. Yeah. And then how could we overcome that? And maybe, I mean, when you say that you have done, which I really am so happy that, you know, for the research that you've done on psychological safety, maybe if you could tell us, like, you know, one or two things that drove you, right? Drove you to...
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, in the VOCA world, you know, and I think this is even more, like, I just give you an example. In post-COVID, there's so much... uncertainty, so much ambiguity.
Yes.
Honestly,
never faced any. I mean, none of us, I think, alive today, have ever faced this level of uncertainty. It's really upheaval. It's our line of sight on what's going to happen in the near future has never been lower.
That's right.
And so if you're not feeling humble right now, you're not paying attention.
And that is so real. And that, I would say that that gives us then a lot to think about here. And I want to say that thank you so much, you know, that, you know, to summarize the many things that you have said, I think I'd like to just reinforce that what you have said is so important. Let's all be in a learning orientation mode. Let us be willing to go into inquiry and the use of voice and silence appropriately, and to be able to also pursue the importance of situational humility, that we all have to be humble enough to say that the reality needs us to now be a fearless organization.
And on that note, we would like to thank Amy Emerson once again for joining us on the PACE podcast. Tune in next time as we move fearlessly forward in this VUCA world.